From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 1-800-NOW-OPEN or open.com.
Mary Lasker first created what would become one of this country's most prestigious medical awards in 1946 as a birthday present for her husband. At the time, she hoped that they would prompt a cure for cancer in 10 years, and although that hasn't happened just yet, many advances have been made, and many worthy scientists throughout medicine have been honored in the process. Well, tomorrow the Lasker Awards will be given to five honorees, including my next guests, Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn from the University of California, and Dr. Jack Szostak of Harvard Medical School, who not only predicted but also discovered the enzyme telomerase. And I'm very delighted that both of them were able to come on my show today. Now, how aware of the Laskers were you before you received these awards? Is this like the Nobels where some people actually will kill to get the award?
Not that I've noticed, but we're certainly in the scientific community, and particularly the biomedical research community, we're certainly aware of these awards.
Yeah, it's a very well-known, prestigious award. It's a long, the list of winners is pretty amazing.
Now, you're being awarded for working on the same thing. You come from different universities. Had you gotten into the research separately at first?
Indeed. And
Liz was involved first, so why don't you explain?
Well, I think it's a wonderful example of how paths cross in science and creative ideas happen when people start talking. I'd been working on telomeres, which is the ends of chromosomes that protect the genetic material, and Jack had been working, he'll explain better, and we got talking at a conference, and things moved, and we our different interests converged, and we started to do some experiments, and Jack can tell you more about those.
But this is the opposite of Leibniz and Newton both fighting over who created calculus. You were happy.
Oh, yeah. I heard Liz give a fantastic talk at a scientific meeting, and it was so interesting. I went up to find her afterwards, and we started talking about some experiments that we could do together. And
But you were at opposite sides of the country, so were you doing them by, and that's before email.
Luckily, there's something called the U.S. Postal Service, and you can send DNA from one university to another still very freely, and so
You were shipping DNA back and forth?
Back and forth, the DNA and the ideas. But I remember the conversation, which was, you know, this beautiful place out in the country, and I think by the time...
in New Hampshire, and we were just walking around outside talking about the experiments and thinking about what pieces of DNA we needed to put together.
And bringing two kinds of ways of approaching the question from different angles. I was coming more molecular biochemically. Jack was coming from a very strong genetic kind of viewpoint, and it sort of gelled. And so I think pretty much by the time we'd finished walking across this lawn,
the
experiments were clear. I mean, you know, there were some particular technical things that needed to be worked out, but it was a sort of far-out idea because we were bringing DNA and cells from very distant evolutionary, parts of the biological world.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but aren't the telomeres kind of like the plastic tips at the end of shoelaces?
You are so right. They're protective of the ends of the chromosomes that carry all the.
Well, what do you mean protective of them? I thought that
they fray. Well, if you don't have
they fray.
If you don't have a proper telomere, a protective structure made of DNA and proteins at the very ends of all the chromosomes, then that DNA starts fraying down and starting to, you know, a little bit like your shoelaces won't work properly if they're frayed, they won't go through the eyelet properly, you start tripping, you know. It's a little bit like that.
And when did people realize this? Was that fairly early in...
People knew that was a problem since the 1930s, but nobody really knew what was going on at the ends of chromosomes, and we couldn't even really think about it until the structure of DNA was understood. Then Liz was really figuring things out in this unusual organism, this single-celled protozoan.
We'd like to say pond scum.
Pond scum.
So that's where you were doing your research on. You were looking at chromosomes of pond scum.
Yes, and, right. And this wasn't...
Well, are they good to research?
They were wonderful, and it wasn't just because I think pond scum is great. You know, I think that life...
Although there's
has,
plenty
life,
of
it. Yes, life has tremendous unifying principles, and it doesn't matter a whole lot if you're looking at fundamental questions, which particular living form you look at, if you're really trying to get at the fundamentals. But my former mentor, Joe Gall, who will be getting another of the Laskers today for special achievement, he had learned that these particular pond scum creatures, little single-celled creatures, have large numbers of very, very short chromosomes. And that means, if you figure it out, lots of N's. And so I joined his lab from Fred Sanger's lab, where they'd figured out DNA sequencing methods that I could begin to apply to these molecules that, frankly, you could get your hands on in a way that just wasn't possible for something like human chromosomes at that time in the technology development of DNA research.
Well, didn't all of this involve predicting something before anyone knew it really existed?
Yes.
Right. So
how does that work? I mean, I understood how endorphins were predicted because I actually spoke to the man who came up with the idea. He said that he recognized that there were these receptors for heroin in our body, so that meant we must have had, there must be a reason for that. And so there must have been a natural version of heroin, and so he came up with the idea of endorphins. Is that the same sort of thing that happened here?
Well, what happened here is that I was working on yeast. It's baker's yeast, which...
So which has pond scum and you have baker's yeast.
Right. So first of all, we wanted...
I'm afraid to think of the cake that you did together.
It was a good one. It rose.
So we put Liz's pond scum telomeres into my baker's yeast, and they worked, which was the first amazing result, and which told us that the whole structure and biochemistry had to be the same in these different organisms. And then...
So pond scum telomeres were exactly the same as the ones that you would have found in baker's
exactly
yeast, but they worked
same, but
in
they
baker's.
Worked. They would protect the ends of chromosomes in yeast.
Now, nobody knew what baker's yeast telomeres looked like then. So, you know, that was an open question at that stage.
So then when we took the pond scum telomeres back out of the yeast and looked at the DNA... we saw that they had gotten larger. So extra DNA had been added on. That was sequenced in Liz's lab. And once we saw what had happened at the level of DNA, it was pretty obvious there had to be an enzyme to add the extra DNA. And that turned out to be telomerase.
And another person
involved...
Well,
it wasn't obvious to everybody. Remember, there were people who fought the idea because it wasn't in the textbooks. And so the idea was... You know, people would draw these diagrams on paper, very elaborate diagrams, trying to force a mechanism by which the DNA could have done what we had observed. But in answer to your question, it's the same in a way. When you looked carefully at, you know, in the case of the endorphin receptors, the heroin receptors, in the case of our case, you looked carefully at what the cells told you. You looked at it and you analyzed it and you said, this is reality. This is what's in these cells. How does our theoretical framework take care of that? And so then you have to say, well, you could push this hypothesis and that, but it starts to get very uncomfortable, and why not think of this?
A simpler solution.
And there were other things sort of converging on this. There was this hint from that, you know, trypanosome, sleeping sickness. They had provided some hints. The pond scum, they had provided some hints. So things were converging in a way that said, aha, you know, this is not an implausible hypothesis that there's something else.
Right. There were other things that made it a little more confusing and complicated. There are lots of viruses that have DNA ends that are completely different. They work in a totally different way. So, yeah, it wasn't really obvious until later on. The ideas were confirmed when the enzyme was actually identified in Liz's lab.
My guests are Dr. Jack Szostak of Harvard Medical School, who predicted and discovered telomerase, and Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn, the Morris Herstein Professor of Biology and Physiology in the Department of Biochemistry and Biophysics at the University of California, who collaborate. Oh, I guess they did it together, and they're both winners of the 2006 Albert Lasker Medical Research Awards, which are often called America's Nobels. They've been given to 71 scientists who subsequently went on to receive the Nobel Prize, including 20 in the past 16 years. This is WNYC 93.9 AM820. We're online at WNYC.org. Another person involved in this research was Carol Greider. A lot of Lasker Award winners all working on the same thing?
Sometimes they're shared. I mean, there've certainly been situations where, you know, independently and together, and we're a case of, you know, sometimes together and sometimes independently, it all interwove.
Now, you said that there was resistance. Is this typical? Is there do scientists resist even when you say, you know, I found it, here it is?
There was no resistance when we found it.
Right. It was just when you were proposing it.
But when you're proposing it, mostly science is very conservative, as it should be. You scrutinize, you have to be very critical. Any fool can come up with a crazy idea. But unless you have evidence...
We had lots of crazy ideas back then.
And so unless you have evidence, then, you know, quite rightly, it's not accepted by the community. Once we discovered telomerase as a biochemically identifiable thing, there was very little resistance that I was aware of. I mean, maybe people resisted and I didn't know. But
the data were the data.
But no, I only meant resistance because, you know, if you're going to propose new things, and biology often works on precedence, you know, then you do have to have some actual data.
Now, how long before people thought about possible applications of this?
I think that came along much later.
Beginning of the 90s, I think, once people started noticing telomerase.
In human, people looked at it in human cells and started following the structure of telomeres, you know, getting shorter as cells get older. They divide too many times and their DNA ends get shorter and shorter, and that causes problems.
So what happens when you add telomerase to human cells that are grown in culture dishes?
What happens is that
human cells have very limiting amounts of telomerase. People thought most normal cells have none at all. They have a teeny little bit if you look hard enough. Even normal cells in adults who can be quite old. But it's not enough, and that wearing down of the telomeres that happens, it just outpaces what telomerase can do. So if you now experimentally add a big, you know, bolus of extra telomerase to the cells and keep it functioning in the cells, then they will now keep their telomeres maintained, they don't fray away and wear down, and then the cells keep multiplying pretty much forever.
So we can create cells that will live into infinity.
That's right. And so now the question is, do we want to?
Yes.
And so, of course, cancer tells us that we should be very cautious about doing that.
Well, can this be applied in reverse in dealing with cancer?
Well, we should go back to, should we think about adding telomerase to normal cells? And the answer is a little tweaking. You know, now this is far reaching into, you know, future applications, but the observations that, you know, have been made clinically in terms of people's natural amounts of telomerase says that having a little bit more is certainly correlated and associated with better health outcomes by a variety of things, cardiovascular disease and other things, than a little bit less. So this is natural.
That would be the obvious worry, right? Since so many cancer cells bring back their telomerase.
Yes, in huge amounts. But the natural little amount in cells, in mice, if you take it away and take away some safeguards genetically in mice, they become, paradoxically, you might think, more cancer-prone, because the telomerase is keeping the ends from being promoting unstable events. But as Jack said, in a cancer cell which has had other genetic and other changes, you know, these are bad cells, then having all that telomerase is bad news, because now you're letting, you know, the hardened criminal cells, the cancer cells.
You're protecting them.
You're protecting the hardened criminals. You're giving them permission. But before they become that way, for a normal cell, actually a little telomerase is not a bad idea at all. And so that's the interesting therapeutic window that
it's
I
a
think.
Very tricky.
But it's a tricky balance, and we would not want to go into this blinded. I mean, you know, you want to go into this kind of thing in terms of interventions very carefully. Right. But you can look at what nature tells you and what your own cells.
But people are, I'm not involved in this, but there are people that are trying to develop drugs to treat cancer that will inactivate telomerase.
We have to take a little break. My guests are sharing a Alaska Award, Dr. Jack Sostak and Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with two of the winners of the 2006 Albert Lasker Medical Research Awards, Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn, the Morris Herstein Professor of Biology and Physiology at the Department of Biochemistry and Biophysics at the University of California, and Dr. Jack Sostak of Harvard Medical School, who the two of them predicted and discovered telomerase, and that has turned out to be a very important discovery. People listening will notice that both of you have foreign accents to varying degrees. So is that also typical of American science? That I guess, Jack, you're a Canadian. Elizabeth, you're from Australia?
I was born in Australia, spent some time in England, ruined my accent.
I grew up mostly in Canada, but came here for graduate school and have been here for quite a long time.
Now, is it true that the DNA we're born with is the DNA we die with?
Well, largely it is, but it is subject to mutations, and the ends of the DNA molecules that make up the chromosomes in all the cells of our body, they're subject to a slow wearing down over the many, many decades of life that humans have.
Because as cells split, they weaken?
They don't weaken so much as they can't completely keep their length up, and so over time, the DNA ends become sort of gradually worn down, unless counteracted by the activity of the enzyme telomerase.
But this is in humans. In pond scum, yes. they keep the thing going continuously. In humans, they kind of break down.
That's right. Pond scum and yeast have lots of the enzyme telomerase, and they're in effect immortal, if we think of immortality from the point of view of the genetic material rather than necessarily the bodies of the cells, because the bodies of the cells themselves can have some mortality, but the DNA keeps going, which means the cells have to keep repairing it.
It's balanced, right? The amount of repair exactly balances out, on average, the amount of shortening.
Well, do adult cells manufacture telomerase?
In humans?
Yeah.
Very low levels, except for, as we were saying before, in cancer cells where you have a lot.
What about sperm
and
egg cells?
Stem cells, right.
We're back to that problem.
You bet. We can never leave. Stem cells, you know, are always with us, and that's good news for us as adults, because our stem cells replenish our immune systems, our skin, our gut lining throughout life. So there's actually, telomerase does have quite substantial ability to work in certain cells, but in many cells it's very, very low, and it is not enough to counteract completely the wearing down of the ends.
So do the restrictions on working with sperm cells affect telomerase research these days?
On stem cells?
Yeah.
Yes, I've often thought of certain scientific questions that I think would be wonderful to answer, and I'm sure many others have, and it has been something where it's an enormous process to be able to work with human stem cells. So it is limiting the ability to ask certain kinds of basic science questions, which could have useful medical ramifications, as telomerase did. You know, it was a basic science question that Jack and I were asking back in, 1980, but it was something that turned out to have ramifications.
15 years later, people started figuring it out.
15 years later. No. 5 years
In the human work started the probably human 15 work. Years after our initial collaboration.
Yeah, that's
so there was
true.
Definitely a long leg before the real implications came out.
Right, and they're still not
and
clear.
They're still being worked out.
Yes.
Well, a lot of things are unclear. Yes. I've read both sides of an argument about the role that psychological stress may play on the disease process.
What's the other side?
Well, some people say it may not play much of a role. You suggested
then they probably have not looked at the quantitative evidence, because I think that there's now a great deal of cumulative evidence that certain kinds of stress, and you do have to define it as precisely as any other scientific term, properly defined, there are indeed clear sets of evidence that it does have clinical outcomes that are quite quantifiable.
In certain diseases?
Well, no. If you call life a disease, chronic stress...
Well, I know I'm dying.
Chronic stress in certain settings, which are clearly defined as settings where it's out of control, where it's not a situation where the person perceives they have the resources to cope, and serious things like that can be quantified, then we do see quite clear clinical outcomes, and a lot of studies have shown relationships in that kind of setting. So these are not even diseases. Now, they can lead to disease risks going up.
Now, you said that telomerase will eventually have applications in fighting cancer, but it may take a while. What's being done? What's next in that research? I know, Jack, you're not doing that. I want to get into what you're doing now, because it's fascinating. But Liz, what's happening there?
Well, there's various ways you can approach the question. You can try to inhibit telomerase in cancer cells. That's certainly a valid thing, and that's various molecules have been devised. You can also
To target the cancer cells, but no other cells.
And that's the trick. Delivery is the trick, and specificity. And then the other kind of thing you could think about is an approach I like more, which is to say, well, let's make it a disadvantage for the cancer cells to have this abnormally large amount of telomerase. Let's make them make something toxic. We've persuaded them in the lab and in test research animal models to make toxic telomeres, and cancer cells hate it. But that's a long way from a drug, and yet it seems to tap into a vulnerability of cancer cells that may be promising. So we're trying to understand that, but that's another way of thinking about it.
I mentioned that you're doing something different these days, Dr. Shostak, but it's connected, isn't it? You're looking into the origins of life, as I understand it.
That's right.
Trying to recreate the old chemical soup that
well,
actually.
Well, that's probably too hard to do. I mean, we don't really know what the conditions
were like. Because I remember reading years ago, and that somebody put a whole bunch of different things together. Then they were shooting electricity into it, and nothing was happening.
Well, you can make all kinds of complicated mixtures of compounds, but it's hard to be sure that that's really relevant, because we don't know very much about what the conditions were like on the early Earth. But you can look at it in a more general way and just try to understand how it's possible to go from certain kinds of complicated chemistry to transition into really simple biology, which really means getting chemical assemblies to behave in a way that they can evolve.
I'm talking to two winners of the Lasker Awards this year, Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn and Dr. Jack Shostak. Two of the five Lasker Award winners are women this year, and Dr. Joseph Gall is getting a special achievement award in part for being an early champion of women in science. He trained you, Dr. Blackburn, didn't he?
Yes, I was his postdoctoral fellow at Yale University in the 1970s.
Was he unusual at the time in encouraging women?
I believe that is the case. He was certainly a wonderful mentor, and his lab, had very, very good people in it. And I think what's telling is how many of them have gone on and become, productive and fulfilled and successful scientists. And so I think that long-term record is probably very indicative of his mentoring, which he never, sort of made a big deal of at the time, but you certainly, as somebody in his group, I could very much appreciate his excellent mentoring.
Well, it seems to still be rare. There was an article in the New York Times last week about how women in science and engineering are hindered not by lack of ability, but by bias. So do you foresee sometime in the future when this is not going to be an issue?
Well, I would hope so. What's happened is that what used to be called the pipeline is no longer true because, half of the PhDs and postdocs in biological sciences are women. I think 42% of the undergraduate math degrees are women. There's no question of interest and aptitude in it by women. We see the big bottlenecks occurring somewhat later when the faculty positions are being sought, and as one looks through the ranks, through academic and research institutions, one sees more attrition of women. My contention is they don't grow suddenly stupid. It's not so we have to look very seriously as to the the societal underlying reasons for this, which are not just science. And so
the subtle biases that are built into the institutions, and people just not acting in a really conscious, clear way. It's also interesting how it varies with field. I think biology has progressed a lot in terms of having more women scientists at higher levels. There's a serious lag in chemistry, physics, and engineering.
But I do point out that I was the only woman chair in our large medical school at UCSF, and that remains the case, that there's always been one woman chair. So in the, what you might call the upper, if you will, sort of echelons of academia, one does find still the underrepresenting of the numbers, which no longer are a pipeline issue because you can't look at it. So you have to say, well, in terms of the training, the people who go into science and love science. So we do have to, keep awareness and not,
looking
well,
at
Dr.
it. Yeah,
Blackburn.
We don't want to lose this marvelous talent to these other sorts of factors.
You have another distinction, the distinction of being removed from President Bush's Bioethics Commission. What happened there?
Well, I think I liked evidence a little too much, and so I was concerned in the writing of reports by this council that the scientific evidence, which was the one thing I really could contribute in assessing to the council, since I, come as a sort of seasoned person by then in how science is and how to try and assess evidence, so I thought that was something I could really contribute to the cell biology areas in this council. And so I would get into many continuous arguments about what the reports would say. So I'm assuming that my nuisance value in this regard was the reason why I was not continued on the council.
Is that a problem today? We've been reading about a kind of a brain drain, people leaving the United States to work in Asia and in Europe on things that we would have assumed would have been cutting-edge science in this country simply because of...
Yes.
Is it harder to get funding these days?
It's not hard. Well, funding has become tighter at the National Institutes of Health, for example, but what you're talking about is people who have gone to Singapore, for example, where stem cell research is going on in regulated but clearly
encouraged
ways.
Strongly encouraged as opposed to this country.
Right.
So it's a serious problem, for the future of science in this country.
Yes.
Well,
administrations
change, but once the research has been
going
full force in Singapore, it's going to be hard to get it back?
Yes, and this is a great shame because, biomedical research in the United States is fantastically good. I mean, there's such a breadth and depth of this, and to see this, under threat and suffering attrition in certain areas, not in all areas, that's a real shame because it's such a wonderful resource. And why, I'm sure Jack and certainly I love being a scientist here, because this was such a good place for research wherever you go.
The wonderful thing about being in academia is that in principle you can work on anything that you find interesting, right? And it's very discouraging when I see even some of my best students not really considering careers in academia because it's so much harder these days.
What effect has the debate over whether evolution is science or not had? I mean, everything you do is based on it starts with Darwin, and yet there are people out there who are saying, well, this is just one theory.
I mean, when I'm optimistic, I hope that the work that we're doing will help to convince more people that evolution is just a natural phenomenon and nothing to be afraid of. On the other hand, intelligent design people are difficult to argue with rationally.
But is there a big, do you see a big gap between what's happening on your level and what's happening in other parts of the country?
Yes, it is divisive because there are certainly different ways of viewing the world. And I think when there's an intolerance between the different ways of viewing the world, that to me is the worrying thing. And if there's a wish to impose certain views of, how the world works, what is reality and so forth, then that's something that, if there's not a tolerance for ideas, then we have to start getting concerned.
And Jack, you've talked about the exciting time at Cornell in the mid-70s when recombinant DNA was literally being invented. So are we moving backward in a way? Or again, are the universities simply doing what they're doing and the top research labs doing what they're doing and then having the rest of the country not paying much attention?
Well, I think there are just some areas that are particularly controversial, like the stem cell areas where...
Well, does it bother you? Do you see an ethical problem here, as many people do?
No, I don't. I mean, on the other hand, I don't work on stem cells, but...
I don't work on stem cells.
But your work is linked to stem cells, as you say.
It certainly relates to an intimate part of their biology, that's true. So I think about them, but I don't work on them.
But what about the research into the origins of life? Because that could be controversial as well.
Especially for people
who read the Bible as literal history.
A few years ago, we did an experiment that showed that a simple clay mineral could do some really interesting things, play an important role in the origin of life. And I got lots of emails and letters from people who said, this is great. You're showing that what happened, what was said in Genesis or in the Quran was correct. So that wasn't necessarily my interpretation, but people will look at it in any way they want to look at it.
Meanwhile, congratulations on the Lasker Awards. I've been talking to two winners of the 2006 Albert Lasker Medical Research Awards, often called the American Nobels. The statistics are shocking. 71 Lasker winners went on to receive Nobels, and I hope you do as well. Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn, the Morris Herstein Professor of Biology and Physiology at the Department of Biochemistry and Biophysics at the University of California. And Dr. Jack Szostak, Szostak, of Harvard Medical School.
No, C.
Okay. Well, whatever. And I thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, we examine the political and cultural impact of the 2004 murder of Dutch filmmaker Theo van Gogh by a young Islamic extremist. And then a new film explores life in 1980s Astoria. We'll hear about a new novel set against a backdrop of racism in 1940 Chicago, plus the latest Please Explain. By the way, if you've missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs at WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Melissa Egan with Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blakeney Schick. We had help today from Lorianne Kraszewski and Shauna Miller. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host, and I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.